studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Howard Bryant is my guest this week. You've heard him on NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday doing the sports, and he has written for a number of newspapers and magazines, including The Mercury and The Oakland Tribune. His latest book is The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. Howard Bryant, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Race plays a major role in the story of Henry Aaron, of course, and you've written previously about race issues in the game. Are you drawn specifically to race issues when you decide to write a book?
Well, I think that I'm drawn to issues that are central to the story of this country, and clearly between race and class, it's very difficult to topple those two. You kind of always, if you run into important subjects, you're going to have to confront those two issues. And especially if you're going to confront those issues historically, if you're going to write about 2010, obviously the racial dynamic of any story is very different than if you're writing about 1934 or if you're writing about 1954. And Henry Aaron's story is mostly set in the greatest period of upheaval probably in this country's history, that period between when his father was born in 1908 until he broke the record and retired in 1974 and then retired in 1976. And so that, you know, that period in the 20th century is where this country went from one dynamic to another, and it's very difficult to avoid race if you're going to take on the subject of Henry Aaron.
Well, I remember watching Nightline on the 40th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's Breaking the Color Barrier, so that was like 87.
87, sure,
and,
the Al Campanis.
The Al Campanis, for those who may not remember. He was asked, did he still think that there was racism? I think the question was, why hasn't there been more African-Americans as field managers? And Campanis said, well, a black athlete is fleet of foot but lacks the necessities.
Sure.
That's kind of revealing that there was still a lot of racism. What about today? Do you think race is still an issue in baseball today?
Oh, I think race is as much an issue in baseball as it is in society. It's not that the game is any different from what's happening outside of it. I think that if you look at, I mean, the dynamics are certainly different. In Henry Aaron's time, the racial questions were much more pronounced in terms of the starkness of them. Well, the black players lived in one part of town, the white players lived in another. There were no black managers. There were essentially a handful of black players. That dynamic obviously is not the dynamic of today. Today's questions are a little bit more subtle but no less important in terms of questions of participation and questions of ownership. It's not so much a question of compensation anymore as much as it is opportunity and inclusion. And I think that, and especially in Henry's case, in Henry Aaron's case, when he looks at the racial component of baseball today, he wonders why the black participation is so low. And my attitude on that and his are actually very similar. He and I had dinner in June in Atlanta. And if you look for talent, you're going to find it. And this has always been an economic issue. You really can't separate race from economics. And in Henry's time, that first wave, that first generation of African-American ballplayer was the cheapest source of talent. Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, they all signed their contracts for less than $6,000. And today, the cheapest source of talent comes from the Dominican Republic. African-American players are very expensive commodities today, whereas in Henry's time, they were not. And so because of that, you find that you've got a different racial question, but it's still a question.
And I want to talk more, believe me, I want to talk a lot about The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron in a minute, but let me just stay with what's some current events, if you will, for just a minute. Do you think race played a part in the, I don't know, persecution, if you will, of Barry Bonds?
Well, sure. I think race played a component. I mean, there's a racial component to the Bond story. I tended to think that race was not central it was not the central issue to Bonds. I think that obviously there is a double standard when you take the steroid-tainted Bonds and compare him to the treatment of the steroid-tainted Mark McGuire. But clearly you also have two different dynamics in terms of their personalities and who they are as people, and also where the game was at the time. I think in 1998, baseball was certainly unwilling to confront or even acknowledge the existence of anabolic steroids and performance-enhancing drugs in the game because it was too busy watching Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa and trying to distance itself from the memory of the 94 strike. I think 3 years later, and obviously later as Balco came and then as Bonds came to breaking Henry Aaron's record, obviously the ground had shifted. And as the ground had shifted, so too did the way the public and the way people inside of the game looked at these people who were creating these unbelievable accomplishments. And so, obviously, 1998 was not 2007. At the same time, certainly the combination of Bonds' personality, which has never been easy, and certainly his blackness, there's no question that those two made for a very easy villain, a very easy target. But I still think that when it comes to steroids, the question of selective justice has been far less racial and far more personality-based. David Ortiz is just as dark as Barry Bonds, and he's gotten a free pass, and he's never explained his alleged steroid use or his existence or alleged existence on the list of confidential performance-enhancing drug testing back in 2003.
So if Bonds were more friendly to the press, then things
would... Exactly. Whoever's the nice guy, if you were good to me. And Bonds wasn't good to many people. Barry had a lot of people waiting for him on the way down. A lot of people. And that's not a racial component. That's not a racial dynamic. On the other hand, Ortiz is one of the most affable people I've ever covered. And so you have a very difficult time watching him... Watching him... face a lot of trouble, and watching him have to face down the possibility that his feats were illegitimate. But I'm never going to say that there was no racial element to the treatment of Bonds. I just think that there was a number of forces, and race happened to be one of them.
Well, on the subject of steroids, you know, there are some people who say, well, you know, as time progresses, there are modern changes that occur in the game. They have better helmets and cleats or whatever, and isn't steroids just one more of those things? Or then there are people who say, well, it's unfair and it's cheating and so on. Where do you weigh in on the steroids issue?
Well, obviously, after having written my second book, Juicing the Game, you know, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball, it's clear that this is an issue that has taken a lot of my time. My attitude on all of this is that I don't think there's anything innocent about anabolic steroid use. I don't think there's anything. It's obviously a technological progression and a scientific and a cultural progression. There's no question about that. But there is also, it's also unambiguous that the players thought they were cheating. The players who were using knew they were cheating. They weren't. This was not simply a philosophical discussion as you might have with, say, laser eye surgery, where old-time ball players retired because of their eyesight, and today's ball players get to play 5 or 6 or 7 more years at a high level because they can get their eyes readjusted. And the reason why I say that they knew they were cheating is because if it were, or if it had been, a philosophical discussion when baseball did not necessarily have specific enforceable rules with penalties, the players wouldn't have denied it. They wouldn't have lied about it. They wouldn't have hid it. They all acted as though they had something to hide. And the minute you asked them about whether or not they used, you know, Mark McGuire didn't say, well, sure, I use steroids because right now we don't have any rules in the game. And until someone tells me that I shouldn't use it or I can't, or as soon as there's enforceable testing on it, I won't use. He didn't say that. He said, no, I didn't do it, because he knew he was doing something wrong. The same was true for Jason Giambi, and the same was true for Alex Rodriguez, and all of them. they've all followed the same pattern of hiding something that they knew was unacceptable. And that's the reason why I never buy the argument that, well, you know, there were no rules or it wasn't against baseball law, whatever that is. I mean, it was against the laws of the United States since 1990.
Uh-huh.
So the players knew what they were doing. And the reason why they hit it is because they knew it was wrong.
To some extent, isn't cheating a part of baseball? I mean, Gaylord Perry knew he was cheating, or whoever. You know, they always had
something. Yeah, it is, but I've always felt that the goal of a society is to become a better society. And Ty Cobb would not be allowed to be Ty Cobb in 2010. In 1910, he was allowed to be Ty Cobb. The society wasn't as evolved. I don't think that in 2010, in the framework of 2010, you would have Gaylord Perry bragging about cheating. He would not be bragging about breaking the rules and spitballs or otherwise. He certainly wouldn't be voted into the Hall of Fame today in the backdrop of anabolic steroids and the entire cheating debate. Back then, it was considered more gamesmanship. I've never felt that it was a justification to apply yesterday's rules to today. This is not yesterday. We don't act the way we did yesterday.
Do you think the doors of the Hall of Fame are closed to Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and people like that?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I mean, as a Hall of Fame voter, I would say that there's a pretty good chance that I'm not going to vote for them. I haven't voted for Mark McGwire. I will not vote for Rafael Palmeiro. I think that Alex Rodriguez is a very interesting case because he's young enough right now where he may have, if he stays healthy, 8 or 9 or 10 more years as a big league player. And inside of those 10 years, the society is going to move again. It's going to shift. You're going to have different Hall of Fame voters, and those younger Hall of Fame voters have grown up, essentially, professionally in the steroid era. And I'm sure their attitudes are far more different than mine. And I think that that's going to be a very interesting question about what the vote is going to look like for players like that, especially guys who you're not even going to vote for another maybe 15 or 16 years. Who knows what the world is going to look like then? As of today, you have someone like Roger Clemens who's eligible in 2012. You've got Mark McGwire who's already been eligible, and you can see he hasn't gotten 30% yet. Those players, I don't think, are going to get into the Hall of Fame at all. Barry Bonds is eligible, I believe, the same year Roger Clemens is, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, I'm very interested. Right now, for me to not dodge the question, I'm not going to vote for either one of them. And I think that my criteria, people say to me all the time, well, how can you differentiate? Who do you vote for in this era? How do you know? And I say, you don't know. But just because you don't catch everyone, or just because you don't have a 100% clearance rate in terms of who did what, doesn't mean that the default is automatic induction for everybody. We know that Alex Rodriguez used anabolic steroids. We know that Barry Bonds used human growth hormone. He used performance-enhancing drugs. He says he did so unknowingly, but he did say that he used them. And we know that about certain players. We know Rafael Palmeiro failed a drug test, and so did Manny Ramirez. So those questions are very easily answered. We don't know if Albert Pujols did or did not, but we do know what Alex Rodriguez did.
We're talking with Howard Bryant, and he's written a fantastic book about baseball, and it's called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. It's a marvelous book, and he's Hank Aaron to most of us, but you're very careful about drawing the distinction between Henry and Hank in your book.
Well, yeah, well, one of the things that I'd found in one of our first encounters, our first public encounters, was when we went to, he was doing a signing in New York, and I went to go meet him, and it was very, very clear that they are two different people. I think when we talk about fame, most people are so taken by the concept of fame that they assume that being famous is the natural goal of someone who's talented. And that's really not true. Henry Aaron was famous because he had an incredible talent, but I don't think fame is essentially something that he sought. He's very uncomfortable with that. He's an introverted person. He's not, I think, with some athletes and some famous people, Reggie Jackson or John Wayne or Ted Williams or some of those people, essentially what you see publicly is what you get privately. And I don't think that's true for Henry Aaron. And I noticed that when I was with him, everybody in his inner circle referred to him as Henry. They all refer to him as Henry, except Dusty Baker. There's nobody in Henry's inner circle who is a confidant, who is a friend, who has known him for a long time, that calls him Hank. Hank Aaron is a public creation. It's a public creation as a vehicle for his talent. And when that spotlight goes away, he's Henry Aaron. And we had to be very careful about that because I wanted the book to be representative of Henry Aaron the man, not Hank Aaron the baseball player. But it was a very hard question for the publisher because the publisher wants to sell books and the public knows him as Hank. But I thought that that wasn't going to be right to call him Hank when he doesn't call himself Hank.
His greatest accomplishment that he's known for, I guess, is catching Babe Ruth in the all-time home runs. And he did it without steroids. But was that an accomplishment that he set out to do, or was he just trying to get as many hits as possible in the same way that he didn't set out to be famous but became famous by being so great?
No. I think that for about, I would say about a decade, he wanted that record. And Joe Torre told me that he recognized the change in Henry's approach probably in about 63 or 64, when they were still in Milwaukee, and he had noticed, I mean, Henry Aaron was a right-center alley line drive hitter. And when you hit that many line drives in that power with that kind of power, the ball's going to get out of the park. And Joe noticed that during that same period, there were a lot of pitches suddenly that Henry would usually drive into the right center alley that he was laying off of, trying to find another pitch that was more middle in, to the middle of the inside of the part of the plate. And that told Joe that Henry was now trying to hit home runs. That in the first 10 years of his career, he was not trying to hit home runs. He was simply so good that he had gotten his share of home runs. But starting around the early to mid-1960s, he was now looking for that home run pitch. And you could see two things happen. One was that his career average at that time was 322, and over the next 10 years it would drop 17 points, but his home runs would increase. And I think that he also realized, and I think the civil rights movement had a lot to do with it, I think that Henry's a very, very controlled, very quiet person who smolders about what he feels to be injustices. And I think that he realized that he had to have something that was going to separate him from the rest. He didn't have the charisma of Willie Mays, the deftness and the verbal agility of Muhammad Ali, or the education combined with the politics of Jim Brown. But he felt everything that those athletes felt. And I think that he knew that he needed some sort of platform that would make sure that people would talk to him or listen to him. And I think he realized that. Also, after seeing what happened with Roger Maris, I think he also realized that the home run, when he had first gotten into the league, his goal was to catch Stan Musial for the all-time National League record in hits, 3,630. But I think he also realized that by 1964, 65, 66, the home run was more important than the hit. And that was the record that I think he knew if he could get that, people would always have to listen to him.
Well, no, you mentioned the civil rights movement there, and Aaron's team moved to the heart of the South in the middle of the civil rights movement in 1965. Well, how did that affect him?
Well, ultimately, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to him. At the time, he didn't want to go. He's a kid from Mobile, Alabama, moving back to the Deep South in 1965, 66 was not anything that he saw as a very appetizing prospect. He was comfortable in Milwaukee. Milwaukee had pretty much been where he had grown up as a professional. He also realized that there was a difference in white Americans that he hadn't seen in the South and didn't want to return to that there were a few different types of America. And Milwaukee was a very segregated city, but it didn't come with the same sort of debilitating hostility that he experienced in the South and did not have a great deal of enthusiasm about going back. However, and he and I talked about this, when you think about the Braves remaining in Milwaukee and Henry Aaron not going to Atlanta, not meeting Andrew Young, not meeting Martin Luther King, not meeting Ralph Abernathy, not being at the center of where America was changing, then he may just become just another ball player. And I think that he realizes that at the time it didn't seem like the right thing, but to be in the middle of the movement was exactly what he was looking for.
Well, let me ask you about his teammates' relationship with him, especially when he was in pursuit of catching Ruth's record. Did that rub his teammates the wrong way? I mean, he just wants to get his home runs kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. I think that he commanded so much respect in the clubhouse that Henry was never really one of the guys, but he was also not, as they say in baseball parlance, a big leaguer. He didn't big league people. He didn't send you that message that, hey, I'm a better player than you, therefore I'm a better person than you. And there's a lot of that in a major league clubhouse, but that wasn't how Henry conducted himself. Therefore, he had always had the respect of his teammates. And I think because of that, he didn't have to worry about his teammates believing that he was acting out of selfishness. I don't think that he ever had a problem with any player for that reason. He had problems with some of his teammates, but not for those reasons. And I think that he, as a player, was always so conscientious about being a professional that it was very, very hard for any player to assail his professionalism. And when he was working with Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr, when they were kids coming up, professionalism was the first thing he tried to teach them.
Well, what about with his rivals on other teams, specifically Willie Mays? Did he have a problem with Mays?
Well, I think it's more the opposite. I think Mays had a problem with him, and I understand it. I understood. I tried to understand both people, and I tried, when I wrote about them both in Chapter 12, I recognized that you had to have a position on their relationship. I think Henry Aaron truly admired Willie Mays. He was always very deferential to Mays as Mays being the better all-round player. He never deferred to Mays as being a better hitter. Henry always believed that he was a better hitter than Willie. And I think where they had their biggest issues was that the narrative of Willie Mays was that Willie Mays was supposed to be the guy to break Babe Ruth's record. He was the guy. He was the first universally beloved black superstar in Major League history. Jackie Robinson was respected. He was not beloved. Willie Mays set the salary for black players. Willie Mays was the iconic superstar. Willie Mays was the standard bearer. Willie Mays made money for other black players with his barnstorming teams. And I think it was very hard for him to recognize that as he was running out of steam career-wise, that Henry was going to be the guy to get to Ruth. And I think what Henry really wanted was for Willie just to say, hey, congratulations. And Willie could never quite do that. Whenever they would ask Willie Mays, whenever reporters would ask Willie Mays about the record, he would say, well, Hank's got a good shot. He's playing in the right ballparks, which is kind of a subtle dig at the fact that Mays was playing in Candlestick Park in San Francisco, and Henry was playing in Atlanta, where the ball flies out of the ballpark. And then there was also this quiet resentment that, that Mays had lost 2 years to the military, and Henry didn't have to go into the military. And so, to me, that is the beauty of baseball, that when you're trying to break a record, everything's got to go right. Yeah. Ted Williams, had he not lost 5 years to the war, to two wars, maybe he breaks Ruth's record before Aaron does. Babe Ruth doesn't have 3,000 hits because he walked so much. Barry Bonds doesn't have 3,000 hits because he walked so much. And so everything has to go right to break a record. And I think that all Henry really wanted was for Willie to acknowledge that he was a really good player too, But I also understand in Mays's case, when you've been on top for that long, it's kind of hard to let the other guy behind you pass you by.
Well, the book is called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, and of course he's lived quite a while since he was a ballplayer. What kind of a guy is he now? You've gotten to know him.
I think he's very comfortable now. I think that one of the things that I gravitated toward when I was thinking about doing this project was that, unlike Willie Mays, I think Henry Aaron had a second act. I think that Henry really, truly wanted to be known as a citizen of the world, as a person of the world, and not as an old ball player. So I think he spent a lot of time, you know, with his foundation work at a time when foundation work has become cliche, actually trying to help people. And I think that he truly wanted, I don't think he wanted to be just a retired baseball player. I mean, when you think about Willie Mays' career when he retired in 73, you know, Willie didn't really have a second act. I mean, he spent the rest of his life being Willie Mays. I mean, Henry Aaron tried to follow the Jackie Robinson mission in terms of becoming a farm director and being an executive and being somebody and being active in the Democratic Party and trying to be somebody who used his baseball talent to try to further the struggle, further the cause of African-American advancement. And I think that that has really given him a little bit more currency in retirement than with most other ballplayers. I think the other thing with him as well is that I know that he has wanted very much to be a person that did follow the Robinson mission. I don't know if people know as much about that side of him, which is what I tried to write about, but I know that it was important to him. And I think also he spent a lot of time. There's this feeling that Henry Aaron is a very bitter, very angry man in retirement. And there is a part of him that when it was time for Barry Bonds to break his record, that I'm sure there was a part of him that was thinking the public wanted him to speak out against Bonds, but where was the public when it was my turn, when it was my time in the sun? But I think that his relationship with the Hall of Fame, I think having Bud Selig as commissioner now, in terms of restoring the Henry Aaron name and importance and all of those things, I think this might be the best time to be Henry Aaron. I think he recognizes more than ever that the public does care about him, that the public does respect him, especially at a time in the steroid era, that people do return to his ability, and they respect him at a time when we talk about values and honesty and integrity and accountability and all those things. They sound kind of quaint today, and I think that people do look at Henry Aaron more respectfully than ever before, and I think he enjoys that finally.
The book is called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, and the author, Howard Bryant. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. We really appreciate it.
Gary, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks so much, Breanne, and thanks to Howard Bryant, author of The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, for being my guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.